The following talk was given by senior lay student Joel Sancho Benton.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to everyone joining us on live stream via one continuous thread. Welcome to you all. I wanted to talk a little bit today about one of the Eightfold Path factors, right speech. And by extension, I guess, just the use of language, how we use language in our practice, and language and words. And it's something that's always fascinated me, and I've been thinking about this for a while, and I'm glad I have an opportunity to talk to you a little bit about it today. And I think most of us are familiar with Bodhidharma, the ancestral founder of Zen Buddhism, and his oft-quoted remarks that he made about Zen. And he said, "Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, with no reliance upon words and letters, a direct pointing to the human mind for the realization of the ground of being." And, you know, there's always that, for me anyway, early on in my Zen practice, I understood how important Buddhist and Dharma study was in the MRO. And I would see that line, no reliance upon words and letters, and, you know, special transmission outside the scriptures. And I couldn't figure out what was going on there. You know, at one moment we're talking about no reliance upon words and letters, and then at the same time there was this obvious emphasis on Buddhist study here. And but I think over the years I reconciled it somehow in my mind, and they're perhaps not. And they're not different. Perhaps they're not contradictory. We chanted it today. The identity of the relative and absolute said, "Reading words, you should grasp the great reality." So, what does that mean? You know, it's something that's always fascinated me: the power of words. And Master Dogen said, "When people say the Buddha's utterances are comprised of mere words, they don't understand the Buddha Dharma. The practitioner's daily language should be one with the entire 10 directions of the universe. Their words should be upright and non-dualistic. You should clearly understand that because everyday language is the whole universe, the whole universe is everyday language. We should be able to appropriate words freely in our utterances, making an ocean into a mouth, and a mountain into a tongue. This is the daily life of proper language. Therefore, they who cover their mouths and close their ears, yet can speak freely and hear everything, are the truly enlightened people who understand the truth of the 10 directions of the universe." And how do we cover our mouths and close our ears and be able to speak freely? And Dogen is always, I've had an interesting relationship with Dogen since I've been a student, and you know, he was such a master of language, and he talks about everyday language, but you know, if you read anything that he's written, I mean, it seems like he's speaking in anything other than everyday language. And you know, I couldn't figure out what this guy was talking about half the time. And how do we make a mouth into an ocean, and a mountain into a tongue? What does that mean? Is he just speaking metaphorically, or do his writings go a bit beyond that, beyond metaphor? And I encountered Dogen pretty early on when I first came here, and Daido Roshi was in the midst of writing his 300 koan Chobogenzo. And so every Sunday he would come and he would pick one of the koans, and I think he worked through it chronologically, starting from the first one. And I had discussion about it with someone. I think he made it all the way through the 300 before he passed away. But it became obvious to me that he was really impressed by Dogen, and that it was very important, Dogen's writings. And in fact, he would every ango in the fall and in the spring, we would have like a Shobogenzo week, and he would, and it was a full week too. It started on Monday like a Sishin and ended on the following Sunday. And it was really, It was very academic. It was kind of a hybrid between Sesshin and academic Buddhist study. And he would pick a passage from the Shobogenzo and he would go through it line by line, word by word, and sentence by sentence, and we would discuss it, you know, for a week. It was pretty intense. So, you know, it became, because it was so important to him, it became important to me. So I started to read and examine some of Dogen's writings. And as I mentioned, I was at first very baffled by it, and I just couldn't follow what he had to say. And he would use phrases like, a stone woman gives birth to a child in the night, or blue mountains walking backward and blue mountains walking forward. I mean, what does that mean? I would read that. I mean, how is that important in my Zen practice? I just couldn't figure it out. And but it became clear to me that his writings were not something that you could like speed read and gloss over. They really did have to be studied over a long period of time to really kind of sink in. And, you know, as I mentioned, he could have used more basic language, and he chose not to. And I think he understood that his students needed to be challenged. And, you know, I think he understood we as human beings have this propensity to want things to be easy. And easy is not going to cut it. You know, if he wanted to have his students break through and see their true nature. And I think he realized that the use of ordinary language wasn't going to do it. So, you know, but I stuck with it, and I do to this day. And you know, it's interesting to. We're a pretty educated sangha, and which is good. You know, I'm a big fan of education, and it can be a liability, as I think many of us have experienced. And, you know, when you think about it, by the time, I mean, this whole country is pretty educated. By the time we're in fifth grade, we're pretty educated. We're probably more educated than the rest of the world. So it's something for me that I've had to really watch out for, trying to, you know, we have this tendency as hardworking Americans to just put our heads down and just like plow through it with this kind of Cartesian linear process. At least I have been like that. And it just took a while to wear that down, and I'm still wearing that down, and it's something that I need to be aware of. But, you know, as I said, I persisted in my Buddhist study, and at some point, the sutras and Dogen in particular, not in particular, but Dogen as well as all the other readings and the sutras, like the Lotus Sutra and some of the others, They started to make sense to me at some level, and I can't articulate what that means, but they just made sense. And I think I started to realize what the monitors say on Sunday before the talks, that these talks are dark to the mind and radiant to the heart. And I think that's what was happening with me. It was starting to make sense to me somehow. it was wonderful. And I've always been fascinated by the use of koans in Zen practice. And, you know, I think the ancient masters, they recognized pretty early how the use of words in a different way can be a powerful tool for us to see our true nature and, you know, to root out these delusions that are so deep-seated in us. And Daito Roshi, in his book, Sitting with Koans, which is a wonderful book, by the way, even if you're not doing koan study, he says, in order to see a koan, we must go beyond the words and ideas that describe reality and directly and intimately experience reality itself. The answer to a koan is not a fixed piece of information. It's one's own intimate and direct experience of the universe and its infinite facets. It is a state of consciousness. And I think that statement holds true no matter what your Zazen practice is, whether you're doing breath practice or shikantaza or koan study. It's about the direct experience of it, and which is what the Buddha experienced. And, you know, he didn't have koans or shikantaza. He had breath practice is what his practice was, and he was a huge advocate of breath practice. So it's... it's a process of discovery, really, I think. And, you know, we all of us have our stories running around in our heads, and we can generate some really interesting conversations in our head, as we all know. And, you know, but I was thinking about how, what is the karma of thought? You know, it seems so harmless, and, you know, these conversations that we create in our heads, and, but, you know, it was born of my body, mouth, and thought, as we chant. And I think we have this tendency to think that it's harmless. You know, I'm thinking something bad about someone else who's maybe in the room, maybe not. And it's just, you know, what does that do? What is the karma of that? And we think, well, you know, it's no big deal. They don't know what I'm thinking. But it really does, I've experienced this myself, there's an energy that it creates, not only within us, but I think that kind of radiates out into the world, a negative energy. And just the opposite is true with wholesome thoughts. And, you know, there's a wholesome energy that's created that really does radiate from us. As the Faith and Mind poem says, the more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Nothing you will not be able to know. And of course, there's also the beauty of the written and spoken word. And you know, there's certainly a beauty in silence, of course. We're experiencing some of that this week. And there's a story that I like, and I'll relate to you, about the Japanese poet Ryokan that kind of addresses the use of words, or in his case, the lack of. He was a really important Japanese poet and Zen monk, and he lived fairly recently. He died in, I think, 1831. So there's a fair amount that's known about him. And most of his life, he was an ascetic hermit. And his poetry is quite lovely. It's sometimes uplifting and cheerful, and sometimes very melancholy, but it's really sweet and wonderful. But it's interesting and kind of ironic that when people talk about him, if people that would encounter him out in public, out on the road or wherever, they said he was a man of few words. He hardly said much at all. And one of his friends related a story about him. He said, Ryokan stayed with us for a couple of days. A peaceful atmosphere filled our house, and everyone became harmonious. This atmosphere remained for some days, even after he left. As soon as I started talking with him, I realized that my heart had become pure. He did not explain Zen or other Buddhist scriptures, nor did he encourage wholesome actions. He would burn firewood in the kitchen or sit in meditation in our living room. He did not talk about literature or ethics. He was indescribably relaxed. He taught others by his presence. And I think he was truly someone who, an enlightened being, where no trace of enlightenment exists. He sounds like a wonderful guy. What a nice way to live our lives. And I've had kind of this strange relationship with poetry over the years. I really love poetry, and I always love it when Roshi or some of the other people who give talks, recite a poem at the end of their talk. And we have some really wonderful poets here in our Sangha. And but, you know, it seems like when I sit down to try to write poetry, you know, my mind is often so busy that, you know, when I sit down to write poetry, it's like whoosh, everything goes blank. You know, all of a sudden there's this block that I have. But I've been kind of chiseling away at that, and because it is a prominent aspect of our Zen practice, and I think it's very important to learn how to write poetry very simply. I know some of you are probably familiar with the academic Noam Chomsky, and he's someone that I've always admired, and he's a professor emeritus from MIT. And when I hear his name, I always think about activism, because he was such an outspoken activist. And, well, I shouldn't speak about him in the past tense, because he's still living. He's like 95 years old or something right now. But he's still plugging away, and he's so active. He's just a wonderful person. And but his parents were Hebrew scholars, and he over the years he developed as he was growing up a really strong interest in language, and he was a professor of linguistics at MIT. So his whole life has kind of been immersed in that. And he said some interesting things about language. And most linguists theorize that language developed in humans just as a means for simple communication between people. But he has kind of a different theory about it. Seems to have gone a little bit deeper than that, Chomsky. And he said, human language states that language developed primarily for the expression of complex thoughts that to some degree we are born with, rather than just a means for simple communication. And he says that humans are born with an innate biological capacity for language, which we acquire with relative ease. And, you know, over in the office building, there's a... on the second floor, when I go over there, I always look at it, but there's this big wooden stand, and there's an English language dictionary on it. And this thing is huge. If you close this, I swear, this thing is like 6 inches thick. And that's just the English language. That's just one language, and it always blows my mind. Whenever I'm over there, I like to open it up and thumb through it. It's a lot of fun. But, you know, I thought, talk about a complex language. I mean, this is just one language in the many of the world. And... So Chomsky states that the development of language was a sudden emergence of a complex cognitive system. So what relevance does this have to do with our Zen practice? And for me, it fascinates me because, you know, we hear about being born with just kind of being empty. But, you know, I wonder about that. I don't really subscribe to this or deny it, but it's just fascinating to me to think about that, you know, perhaps we're born with a lot going on inside of us that we don't realize, and that that this language that we've developed is a way to express this and release our complex thoughts. And it's interesting to watch a child, I think, that's learning, you know, it's, you know, for a long time they just make these garbled sounds, but once they actually start talking, it's like the floodgates open, and it's really fun to watch. And sometimes you can't shut them up. And, you know, it's, in any case, it's, I guess I brought that up just to kind of illustrate the complex noise that's in our heads, and we all know about that. In fact, one of the things that one of the most pronounced thing the first session I ever came to was how much was running around in my head, just so much noise. And Sishin is such a beautiful thing. I love Sishin because, you know, everything is stripped away. You know, our homes, our loved ones, our cars, our TVs, our computers, our phones. And, you know, we're in a room full of people that are doing, like-minded people that are doing the same thing, sitting in Zazen for a week, but really you're alone on your cushion. And it just blew my mind the first time, is just how much noise there was. And there's a multi-billion-dollar industry that's called marketing and advertising that plays on that offers us things to distract us from actually looking at our true minds. And Dido Roshi used to say, an unexamined mind is a dangerous thing, and that's for sure. And, you know, Sishin gives us an opportunity to look at that unexamined mind for a week. It's really a wonderful thing, a blessed thing, I think. When I was a boy in grade school, I experienced some things I think we all do. And just, you know, as kids grow older, when they get to be 9, 10, 12 years old, how they'll taunt each other, you know. And there was this little saying that we used to have, that sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And I remember one time, and, you know, it was a long time ago that I was in grade school, many, many decades ago. But I live near an elementary school, and I go out for walks by the school sometime, and I went by it one day, and the kids were out there, and I could hear this kid. He was in the distance, but I could hear him distinctly saying that phrase, "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me." And when I was about 10, there was this girl, and she was really good at pushing people's buttons. And one day she had my button, and she was pushing it hard. I don't even remember what it was, but I remember getting in her face and screaming that at her, "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me." But I remember distinctly thinking in my mind, you know, I'll take the sticks and stones any day because those wounds can heal. But sometimes the wounds from words don't heal so quickly. And what does it mean to become offended by people's words? Or when someone says, "You offended me," what does that actually mean? You know, what happens in our bodies and minds when we're offended by someone's words? And I think we all know people. Some people never seem to be offended by anything. And then some people seem to be offended by the tiniest little thing. And one thing I've noticed about myself is I've gotten a bit thicker skinned over the years. And, you know, through Zen practice, but I was so sensitive when I first came in. And what is it? Is it low self-esteem? Is it our egos that does that? The Faith and Mind poem says, "When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. And when a thing can no longer offend, it ceases to exist in the old way." And it doesn't say that the offense disappears, and it just says that it changes. And it ceases to exist in the old way. It's still there, but it just exists in a different way. And what does that mean? Is it still hurtful? Is it still offensive? And I think what they're talking about is just, you know, when the mind does exist undisturbed in the way, we're not just consumed by that, by people's words. And we can just let go of it more easily. But it's something that's interesting to think about, is like being offended. And obviously, our words have power to create compassionate and harmonious worlds as well. And recently, in early May, I was traveling to Eastern Massachusetts, where most of my family is. And every spring, in early May, we have a cookout and a family get-together. And so I'm traveling on the Mass Turnpike. And usually the weather's pretty good that time of year. But in early May, if you remember, it was really cold and rainy. And I just did not want to be on the road. I didn't want to be driving. I just was grumpy and grumbling, and to make matters worse, I got stuck in a traffic jam because of an accident. And I think, you know, it took me about 25 minutes to go 4 miles, and I'm like, rawr, rawr. So I'm in that mindset, and I pull into one of those big, those roadside rest areas that have about 50 gas pumps and McDonald's and all that other stuff. And there's a lot of people there, and people were in a hurry. I was in a hurry and impatient, as most of the people were there. They just want to get in and get out, get back on the road. So as I'm walking into the building with that frame of mind, I looked at this woman in front of me, and she's got this hoodie on, and it says, "You, the person walking behind me, the world is a better place with you in it." And it was just like, poof, it almost physically stopped me. It was about the last thing that I expected to see. And it was just amazing. You know, it was just this one sentence from on the back of the shirt of this bodhisattva at this rest area. And it just blew my mind. Just one sentence, how much that could change my mind, you know, just these one few words. And I wondered about how many other people saw that shirt that day and had the same turnaround that I did. It was a really wonderful experience, actually. And the Buddha talked about harsh speech, and there was another incident that I wanted to relate to you to kind of invoke Yukon's name. But, you know, he was our gardener, if you're not familiar with him. There are some people here now who never met him, unfortunately. But he passed away about a year ago. He was really a wonderful guy, and he was so good with people. And I went out to breakfast with him one time at this little breakfast place down in Phoenicia, a couple of miles away. And there was this woman that waited on us, and we knew her. I don't know her name, but we kind of knew each other because we had been going in there for so many years. And she was usually like talkative and kind of bright. And this day she was not doing well, you could tell. And so we ate our breakfast and we went up to pay. And Yukon said something to her in this very gentle, just this kind-hearted way. And I don't even remember what he said, but it was just the way that he said it that impressed me so much. It was just, it was so kind-hearted and sweet and compassionate. And he let this woman know, just from his speech and the tone of his speech, that, you know, I know where you are, I've been there, and I think she was pretty impressed that, you know, she was really taken by someone who would take the time out for her. You know, most of her customers probably, who cares, you know, but he really cared about people, and it was, and it's easy to do, you know. I mean, that's something we can all do, is just say hello to somebody, even if we're not feeling in a good spot. We can still add to the joy in the world. And, you know, it's tough some days for me. And there are some days when it's just like my practice is okay. Today, just don't add to the turmoil in the world, you know. So I usually, those days don't happen too often, but I just usually keep my mouth shut because the potential is there for me not to be so nice. And as I said, those don't happen too often, but, you know, it really is easy to say some kind words to people. And the use of right words and right speech was very important to the Buddha, obviously. He clearly understood the power of speech in our everyday lives, and he divided right speech into four components: abstaining from false speech, abstaining from slanderous speech, abstaining from harsh speech, and abstaining from idle chatter. And in talking about right speech, Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, "Because of the effects of speech are not as immediately evident as those of bodily action, its importance and potential are easily overlooked. But a little reflection will show that speech and its offshoot, the written word, can have enormous consequences for good or harm. Speech can break lives, create enemies, start wars, or it can give wisdom, heal divisions, and create peace. This has always been so. Yet in the modern age, the positive and negative potentials of speech have been vastly multiplied by the tremendous increase in the means, speed, and range of communications. The capacity for verbal expression, oral and written, has often been regarded as the distinguishing mark of the human species. From this, we can appreciate the need to make this capacity the means to human excellence, rather than, as too often been the case, the sign of human degradation." So true. And, you know, right speech for me is has been one of the challenging aspects of my practice over the years. And I can, not as much as I used to, but sometimes my mouth would engage before my brain engaged. And that's not a good space to be in. And, you know, it's always really disconcerting for me, for just to use an example of gossip and how, you know, it can always be couched in like concern for a friend, and yet, but are you really concerned for the person you're gossiping about? And it can be very subtle but powerful. So it's something that I try to be as mindful as I can about my speech. In the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha talked at length about the use of words. He knew how we can become seduced by words and how our discrimination of meaning is based on elusive false imagination, as he calls it. And he was obviously aware of the importance of language, but he knew that words were only a vehicle for us to use. And sometimes in Zen, the moon is used to designate enlightenment or realization, and that the sutras are the finger pointing at the moon. But I think all of us can, at some points in our practice, be seduced by the words. And that sometimes, as the saying goes, we mistake the finger for the moon. So, and the Buddha says, words and sentences are produced by the law of causation and are mutually conditioning. They cannot express the highest reality. Moreover, in highest reality, there are no differentiations to be discriminated, and there is nothing to be predicated in regard to it. Highest reality is an exalted state of bliss. It is not a state of word discrimination, and it cannot be entered into by mere statements concerning it. The Tathagatas have a better way of teaching, namely through self-realization of noble wisdom. This noble wisdom. And, you know, it takes perseverance. And one time, a few years ago, when Shugen Roshi was giving closing remarks during Open Sozen, he said a few things, and then he ended with, "Those of us that have persevered, persevere." And that always stuck with me, and the importance of perseverance in our practice. You know, it's not for the faint of heart. And so maybe this week we can continue to ride that wave of perseverance that we've been on since Monday. And thank you all for listening. It's been really been a pleasure and a privilege to be able to talk to you today. And I wanted to end with something that that I came across years ago and I haven't seen in a while. And it's not a poem, but it has a kind of a poetic feel to it. And it's from the introduction to the Denkoroku, which is the record of transmitting the light. And it's one of the koan collections that we use here in the Mountains and Rivers Order. And it's about light. This light has been our constant companion in life after life and has never left us. It is beyond qualifications such as pure and impure, temporary or eternal, and is identical in fools and sages. It never divides itself into self and other, or subject and object, but merely wears the faces of self and other. All that we are and do is the result of its presence. It gives us life and makes us die, and we see and hear through it. It is a source of our minds and bodies, and even the use of ordinary discriminative thinking is its doing. It itself is speechless and mindless, has no form or sense faculties, but is not mere nothingness or emptiness. It is, on the contrary, a reality possessed by all beings and the true place to which we all return. Although we are born here and die there, constantly arriving and departing in the cycle of rebirths, this true self does not die. Nor is it reborn, but remains eternally unborn and undying, merely wearing the different faces of ordinary beings, Buddhas, demons, and donkeys. When the world is periodically destroyed by fire, water, or wind, it is not destroyed. In humans, it is nothing but bright light, a clear and distinct knowing.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.